I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Most of 2 years ago, when really nobody knew what Donald Trump was capable of, the canny odd couple of Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader told us exactly. Between the two of them, they had run six fringy, frustrated campaigns, right and left, for president since the 90s. First thing they said about the over-the-top vanity candidate from Trump Tower was that he was something else. Not what he seemed, and no joke at all. Stop laughing and listen up, they told us in our first lesson. We called it Trump This on the radio on August 13th, 2015.
He has the capacity to imperil or to end all Republican chances for taking the presidency in 2016.
Because, first of all, he's a free man politically. You know, that's why people like, in great majorities, very rich candidates, because they all have this saying that nobody can buy a Rockefeller, nobody can buy a Kennedy, and nobody can buy a Trump because they don't need it.
He's got real assets in terms of ability dealing with people and negotiating, undeniably, and getting things done and being an executive. My concern would be, is there an understanding of the complexity and danger of the world around him?
What I think is going on here is that Trump has broken the equilibrium of Republican parties, and therefore he's put into motion a lot of forces that have yet to play out.
He has a certain measure of confidence, self-confidence, that is unusual.
The thing that we don't know about Trump is the extent to which he may implode himself. People think he's got asbestos for skin, but he is actually very sensitive. One of the reasons he lashes out is because he's very sensitive to people who've lashed at him.
A year and a half later, early in the annals of President Trump, when astonishingly few people can vouch for who the man really is, it made sense to ask that voluble duo, Nader and Buchanan, at least what he's up to, for better or worse, and where he's headed. Pat Buchanan was the pit bull strategist in Richard Nixon's White House. He's a Latin Mass Catholic, a cultural conservative, an America First nationalist who has turned sharply anti-empire, calmly post-Cold War with Russia, and flat-out anti-war in the Middle East. Ralph Nader was Mr. Citizen as auto safety crusader, then chief of the relentless raiders against corporate power, and of course, he was a prickly third-party candidate in three presidential campaigns. In three-way conversation this week, I asked Pat Buchanan first to put the fierceness, as it seemed to me, of President Trump's first 10 days in the context of the past, of the world, of the future. I said, he's frightening the horses and the children in all the wrong ways. Could he be self-destructing before our eyes?
The answer is no. I think what Ralph Nader is doing, which I'm glad to see, is what sort of we failed to do in the Nixon White House years when we came in. Nixon was committed to taking down most of the great society, and he failed to do so because he had been advised by Moynihan and others of the terrible reaction. And he never cleaned out the State Department, and he sort of permanently regretted it. I used to speak to him after his presidency. The Republicans have waited a long time for this. They've got both houses of Congress. They've got the White House. They ought to move expeditiously on the executive orders they want to impose, those they want to change and repeal. On this latest mini-crisis they've got on the immigration and on barring refugees and the rest, the only thing about that that's problematic to me is the fact that they didn't properly vet it with the other agencies. They don't have people in proper positions. But what the worst thing that Trump could do right now is to recoil because of the reaction to what he has done. He ought to keep moving on ahead, take the hits he's going to take. He is committed, for me, in three critical areas. To get us out and not involve us in any new wars in the Middle East. Secondly, to secure the borders and repair the immigration system in the country. And third is to start bringing the jobs and the manufacturing back home. And that can be done. It's going to take a period of years to do it, just as it took years to tear down this industrial structure. But I think, a tariff, say, of something like 20%, on all imports into the country, they're $2.5 trillion. That would give you $500 billion. Use that to eliminate taxes on all small businesses in the United States and cut the corporate tax rate to the lowest level in the world and have the companies and have the jobs and the manufacturing starts steadily back into the United States. And he ought to continue to pursue his agenda. And the key thing is not to be frightened off and recoil with the first skirmish.
Pat, I'm making a note of your three big points about no more disastrous wars in the Middle East. Still, he wants to bomb ISIS into eternity. The immigration point and rebuilding jobs. Ralph, what do you see?
Well, I can imagine that Pat has been starved over the years to hear such public sentiments coming out of the White House. But if you look at the other things that Pat cares about, I don't see that much change. I see ominous continuity. For example, we have militarists coming to Washington to take the place of militarists. We have Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, and corporatists coming to high positions in Washington at the behest of Donald Trump. We have a situation where he seems to be wanting to pick a fight with China, if not Russia, and Hillary wanted to do both. We have the corporate state. We have corporate welfare unchallenged. We have a proposal to build more public works and restore them, modernize schools, buildings, sewage, water systems. But he wants to cut taxes, and his own economists on Capitol Hill have said that you can't do both. You got to get the money from somewhere. On immigration, he's not getting to the roots of it, which is one, it's at a 40-year low coming from Mexico, and he's got to address the drug problem, because if he doesn't address the drug problem, as conservatives and liberals have wanted to, the pressure to go north by both the cartel and its victims will continue. And, of course, in the past, it's been Tyson Foods and the meat packers and others who've actually solicited workers, the tomato growers in Florida, because they work hard and are afraid to ask for their rights and aren't paid even minimum wage. So I see some populist bombast, the Carrier Corporation and Boeing comments by Trump. And he just jawboned the drug companies at the White House to reduce drug prices and bring a more drug manufacturer home. But guess what? Pharmaceutical stocks surged higher because they know it's talk. 80% of all ingredients in our pharmaceuticals are made in China and India. Huge numbers of completed pharmaceuticals are made in China and India. He doesn't have the historical and the contemporary knowledge and facts to go beyond a bit of bombast, because the drug companies are getting huge corporate welfare from National Institutes of Health, all kinds of drug research right down to the clinical. They're getting all kinds of tax credits to do research, which is what they should be doing anyway. And still, they have no patriotism to this country. He hasn't raised the issue of corporate patriotism. He knocked through the campaign, China, again, China, China, China. Why China? It's the U.S. corporations that have been abandoning America, as Pat has pointed out in many columns. They have no patriotism. So he's not really going after globalism, militarism, Wall Streetism. And dear to Pat's heart, he's not going out after the commercialism that's ripped the core out of conservative values, spiritual values, and family values.
Pat, you got to speak for Buchananism here. He's doing a pretty good job.
There's a lot of what Ralph said that I fundamentally agree with. Let's take the large corporations. You know, I've described these as sort of great white sharks. They have no morality. They have no patriotism. But what you have to do is you have to create the incentive structure whereby they choose to move in one sea and not in another. Now, if you put a 20% tariff, for example, on all goods coming into the United States, imports into the United States, overall it's $2.5 trillion. That'd give you $500 billion initially. But then the corporations, the people in sitting in their corporate boards, they're going to say, gee, it's going to cost us an additional 20% on our products if we make them abroad. They'll start coming back into the United States, and especially if you start eliminating and reducing the corporate taxes, corporate chieftains will make their decisions, as they always do, on what's best for me, for my shareholders, for my company, for my long-term benefit. You have to restructure the incentives. And I agree with Ralph completely on that. I did not know we were going to make the world safe for Goldman Sachs. And I'm a little surprised to find three or four or five of these guys. You know, one or two might have been okay. The generals are very patriotic and tough folks, and they've been involved in these wars. But they're very hard line, except some of them do tend to agree with the president that we do not want a confrontation with Russia. The Crimea has been a part of Russia since Catherine the Great, and Khrushchev gave it up in a drunken stupor one night in 1954. And the fact that there's a Russian flag over it rather than a Ukrainian flag over it is no reason for the United States to get into the kind of war that every Cold War president avoided when the Russians were sitting on the Elbe River. Mm. But again, with China, for example, I think if you do gradually impose in over 2 years a 20% tariff, frankly, it's not going to be pleasant for China because the companies will be moving out of there. Now, some of them will be going to Southeast Asia, but some of them will be coming home. If you cut the taxes on these corporate guys here, instead of running to Ireland and situating themselves there, they will come here.
You know, if you put a social tariff on imports from countries who don't give their workers any rights and are really unfairly competing with the U.S., there's going to be retaliation. And we have to take that into account in terms of the cost. Of course, the goods will cost more to consumers because the companies will pass them right on. It's really hard to exaggerate the level of interdependence that corporate globalism has imposed on the world, which is a way of stripping the ability of nation states to protect their own people and stripping democracies' ability to challenge corporate domination.
But Ralph, that's exactly right. And there's no question about it. Many of the corporations, they get their work done down in Mexico or in China, and then they bring it back to the United States. Let's take an example of a Lexus, which is a great car. Let's say it costs $50,000. With a 20% tariff on it, it's going to have to cost $60,000 in the United States. Some Americans might buy Cadillacs, and the Japanese will say, look, why don't we simply move production to the United States and avoid the tariff? And that's what we want. And I agree with you. I mean, we are so interdependent now that it's going to take probably the better part of a decade to turn this around, but you can start it in the other direction.
Coming up, the Bannon man behind the travel ban. More Buchanan and Nader on the wobbly Trump takeoff. This is Open Source. Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan have been unelected combatants in national politics for 50 years now, writing, reflecting, imagining, each with his own Walter Mitty dream of being president himself. Both saw the Trump shock coming and told Open Source listeners, brace yourselves. I asked them if they sensed the dismay, distress, disbelief that so many people feel about our president.
But you know, Chris, the high anxiety and the panic is on all the people that disagree with me. I'm not in highly anxious and I'm not panicked, except for the one issue that Ralph raised, which is a lot of these guys, they've got it in for Iran. The think tanks are already working up their on to Tehran programs. And you do have a lot of folks who are very strong military, I wouldn't call them militarists, but they're military guys who believe in military solutions to problems like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm very concerned about that. But I mean, the hysteria we saw when Trump was elected, for heaven's sakes, I mean, you got Schumer is bawling on television over the fact that he imposed this ban. Mr. Bannon and Mr. Miller and others worked it out with Donald Trump. What is this fear and dread? I mean, I can understand it in foreign policies if we're going to go toe-to-toe with the Russians or go toe-to-toe with the Chinese in the South China Sea. But these things domestically, they take a long time. There are bumps, mistakes, all the rest of it. I mean, Ralph can tell you how long these things take.
But hold it. Steve Bannon and Steve Miller working things out on their own gives some people the creeps, Pat. Let's be real about it.
What are they doing other than what Donald Trump told them to do? I mean, Rudy Giuliani was in there. I mean, he said all during the campaign.
Was the State Department in there? Was the Department of Home Security in there? Was there anything remotely like an interagency process? I want you to speak to the anxiety. The question is, the very un-American word coup is in the air.
He's an elected president, for heaven's sakes. Let me say
this. Steve Bannon. Pat, be real about a Bannon regency around this man who, as you say, doesn't know a whole lot about the way the government works. It started with America First on the Inauguration Day, the truculence with Mexico, the executive order about migrants, seven countries, why not 23, why those seven? The FT columnist, let me just say, and I'm not going to quote the New York Times at you because I don't like it much any more than you do, but the FT kind of keeps its cool way offshore there in London. Their columnist called the migrant order un-American, un-Christian, and ignorant. Another FT grandee, Gideon Rachman, is calling Donald Trump an unstable president. And people know what he's talking about. He says the Emperor Nero has now taken power in Washington, and the British have to smile and clap as he sets fires and reaches for his fiddle. There is an anxiety, and it's not just people who voted for Hillary Clinton.
All right, there is. I agree there's an anxiety. We saw the Women's March. We see the hysteria attendant to what took place this week. But Trump said, I mean, I'm sure Bannon believes it. I'm sure the new attorney general believes it. And Mr. Miller believes it. And some others believe it, that we need much more severe vetting on folks who come from where? The seven countries. Three of them are state sponsors of terror, and the other four are fighting war zones. And to put, you know, a temporary ban on folks from there to coming into the United States is not, to me, you know, the beginning of the Third Reich. We hear all kinds of words on various cable channels with which I'm familiar about Hitlerite and Nazi and all this other nonsense. I don't see it. I do agree with you. Some people are terrified, but what Trump does represent is a potential revolution in terms of nationalism and a new realism in foreign policy and in terms of border security and a new immigration policy, much more restrictive, that is very close to a political revolution.
Let me jump in here. There's a lot of dread, and it's well supported, Pat. I mean, I'm going to, in a minute, put the shoe on the Irish foot. But Trump's comments on Arabs and his full support of the Israeli empire and his encouragement for provocative colonies and theft of more land, that's going to lead to a lot of violent activity that's going to spread. There's never been any kind of disruption by any of these Syrian refugees. They have to go through 20 egregious steps in terms of vetting again and again and again. And in Iraq, we have Iraqis who are our allies who have been delayed by Bush and Obama from getting in, and now Trump at the airports. Islamophobia and anti-Semitism against Arabs by Trump is well manifest. When the Irish were fighting for their rights and accused of being terrorists by the Brits, and there were cells in the U.S., I'll bet you that if you had a Trump due to Ireland in terms of this recent edict that they did to Syria, you would be a little upset.
Well, look, if the Irish and the Northern Ireland and the Southern Irish, the Catholics and Protestants, if they're killing one another over there and they bring their quarrels over here, which they did, Ralph, right after the Civil War, a bunch of Irish invaded Canada in order to try to start a war between the British Empire and the United States so they could rip away Canada. I mean, you had problems with those folks, and even though I'm both Irish and Scotch-Irish, where the government should be looking at them. Let me talk about Israel, because it's one of the subjects that, of course, gets me into trouble. Now, Trump has said, and I don't think they ought to do it, he's going to move the embassy to Jerusalem. Now, he's going to move it not to East Jerusalem, Arab East Jerusalem, but to West Jerusalem, which was part of it before the Six-Day War. I don't think he ought to do it for this reason. I don't know what it gains us, and I do know that it causes tremendous turmoil and trouble over there. Now, on refugees, I think we need a new policy whereby for refugees, if the Rohingya, for example, get out of Burma and get to Bangladesh, in my judgment, they aren't entitled to entry into the United States automatically because they were persecuted in Burma. We need a new policy on refugees. Now, with regard to Syrians, I'm not anti-Syrian, but there's no question about it. There are 6 or 8 major terrorist groups, and some of our rebels are associated with them. You got the Syrian government, you got the Russians, the Iranians, the Hezbollah, everybody else in there. And if they're coming out of that war zone and we say, look, we need 3 more months to check you out, that is not, to me, some sort of a neo-fascist policy.
Ralph, your turn.
Well, first of all, the quotas are extremely small. We brought in 750,000 Vietnamese.
We started the damn war over there.
Yeah, we're in a pitched war, and we still brought in 750,000 Vietnamese, a very, very successful immigration policy.
We were responsible for that.
Asylum.
Listen, I agree with you, Ralph. If we're responsible for a war, as we were for the Vietnam War, we were over there, and those people fled the kind of future they had in Cambodia. I understand that, and I go along with that.
The same with the invasion of Iraq, which you and I
think was
ill-advised and unconstitutional, and that lit the fuse in the neighboring
countries.
Well,
I do agree with you that folks who have served us in Afghanistan and work with American soldiers and whose lives would be imperiled if that place goes under, I do agree you bring them into the United States. But if they take a little longer to vet them, what exactly is the problem?
Can I ask both of you guys to change the subject possibly? Should we be looking at the first 10 days of the Trump term as a negotiating strategy in process? Negotiation 101 being take an extreme position, brush them way back.
I think you got a point here, Chris, that the refugee order and the travel ban and all that, when you take a step, and quite obviously it wasn't vetted, so all of a sudden the Brits with dual citizenship, that's taken care of, that problem's resolved. And there are going to be mistakes made, but what I don't understand, I mean, people I know are loving this. Hmm. The fact that they took an initiative, it's not really clearly all the way thought through. There are attendant problems to them, which Ralph's bringing up. That's fine, and those things can be adjusted. But what justifies this shock and awe and terror?
Pat, it's needlessly inflammatory language, one. He just likes to provoke.
Don't we know that?
Yeah, Nixon didn't use needlessly inflammable for the most part. The second is...
Call me and tell me to use it.
He's scaring the big business community. The Republicans, if not you and I, have to be worried
about
that.
That's what they do for a living, Ralph. They worry and they fret. Yeah. And then they wait and see which way the thing's going to tumble.
Yeah, the new Trump stock market has begun, and it's already beginning to slide. But here's what I'd really ask you. What is Trumpism going to do to conservatives, to conservative values, to evangelical Christians who have supported him? I mean, to me, this is a major crisis of conservatism because I don't see Trump at all as conservative.
People ask me, is he a social conservative? I said, from what I read, I don't think so. But if he comes up with a good man on the U.S. Supreme Court who will send issues like same-sex marriage and issues like abortion on demand back to the states and say they are not constitutional rights, and we're about one or two votes away from that. If he will do that, that is fine with me. Look, George H.W. Bush, I never believed that he was really a social conservative like Pat Buchanan, but I was for him on the ticket with Reagan. If he would merely pledge he would support our agenda on A, X, Y, and Z, which he did, in which he followed through on. I mean, you can't demand that Donald Trump be, a Latin mass Catholic like Pat Buchanan as long as he picks the right people for the court.
Pat, I want to compound it a little bit with another question, too. I mean, sometimes I feel you look at Donald Trump as a guy who hit the jackpot on your nickel, so to speak. You were out there first with America First, with jobs export and all that sort of thing. At the same time, he's incredibly different, especially in foreign policy. He has none of your acquaintance or your passion against empire, the idea of it, and the botch we've made of it since Vietnam. He can accuse George Bush and Hillary of making a disaster in the Middle East, but then he says he's going to bomb the you-know-what out of ISIS, as if that wouldn't be more of a disaster. And then there's the cultural piece. You were just saying, you're a guy who loved the culture of families in the 50s, patriotism out of your boyhood, the Jesuit Christian discipline that you learned in high school. Donald Trump is mammon itself. I mean, he is the walking embodiment. You ran to be president of, as you said, God's country, and you meant it.
Right. You know, a friend of mine wrote me, he said, look, it's not the America we want, but it's the America we've got. And Donald Trump came up June of 2015 and began to speak about the border and began to speak about trade and began to speak about exports and jobs and factories shutting down and what it was doing to the country and these foolish wars and how Iraq was a mistake. And you had somebody in the Republican primaries with whom probably on social agenda is really different from me, but he was going to do these things. Now, you don't get everything you want in this life, but of all those Republicans up there, the others were mainly out of the same cookie cutter. They're all responsible for these wars and all the rest of it. And here's a chance for something new. And sure enough, he won. Now, he's the president of the United States. I'm not. And okay, we're not going to get everything I would do, and you're not going to get it the way I would do it, but he's the guy I voted for in the primaries, supported, and he's the president I support right now. And are my fingers crossed? You bet.
Apropos what Chris just said, there's a growing difference between what Donald Trump said on the hustings and the people he surrounded himself with, from Wall Street to war. That's what you have to look at. I mean, you're a pragmatist. You know the difference between talk and deed. And so far, until he got in the White House, he'd get away with talk. And some of it is good talk. Good talk on trade. Good talk on a number of other things. Drug prices too high. Corporations fleeing America, etc. But now, you see, he's in the deed area. And I look around at the people surrounding him, and I see more empire, more globalism, and more Wall Street. Goldman Sachs, can you imagine?
Let's talk first about the more war. There is no doubt, Ralph, and you know it as well as I do, there are unreconciled people in these think tanks and these neocon communities and all over this town who are gearing up for the next big war, and it's against Iran. And there are people that Mr. Trump has brought in, President Trump has brought in, who have a real thing on about Iran. They think it's, I don't believe it's that great a danger. I do believe we may have to fight to the degree we can to prevent some kind of incident occurring, which can be used as basically a casus belli. I agree with you. That's my main apprehension, is clearly in foreign policy. And while these generals and these folks over there, Pompeo and these people, are very able and very competent and excellent warriors, they do have a predisposition toward the kinds of policies you and I disagree with. And we're going to have to fight that battle. The one thing we got in there is this time, at least there's a Trump and even Bannon and some of the people you knock. These are guys who are not enthusiastic about another war.
Pat's making an extremely important point. The biggest danger now is a president with an easily bruisable ego surrounded by aggressive militarists who are basically signaling war or hostilities or looking for a casus belli with Iran. And Iran is not Iraq. Iran has far greater reach in that region than Saddam Hussein had by a long shot. And that means that we have transferred enormous power to a handful of extreme adversaries abroad who now know what bonfire only requires a match. And if they provoke with some sort of attack, either over there or in the U.S., Trump, he's going to go crazy. And he's going to become a monster. And it's precisely because of how vulnerable his character, personality, his associates, nominees, project to these people abroad who say, oh, not only do we have a greater argument for recruitment, now if we have a major attack in the U.S., then the world and the U.S. are embroiled because he has no impulse self-control. He has no diplomatic restraint, and he'll take it personally.
What he does have is this. He has a chance to be, and I think he believes he has a chance to be, the guy that's the great rebuilder of the American nation, securing its borders. He's the America First guy. He's the great patriot, and he's got to know, and I believe he does know from the way he's talked about Iraq and these stupid wars, that the one way you can destroy that is to get into another war, especially a major war with a country like Iran, which is three times the size of Iraq, three times as populous. And so I believe that the best hope you got in there right now is Trump and some of the people around him are quite aware that how these wars start, they're very exciting, and it would start with the big early American victories, and then you'd wind up with a total horror show. And the presidency and the party, they know what happened to Bush. Big war, 2003, 2006, he loses both houses. 2008, they got Barack Obama as president of the United States. I think they realize that. Look, if there's some major horrible 9/11, and you can know, and somebody points it out that Iran's got to be responsible, there is obviously a danger of that kind of reaction.
We got to surface the name of Steve Bannon and who in the world he is. Richard Nixon had you, Pat, as his feisty, clever wordsmith. Trump has Bannon, and he worries me a hell of a lot more. He's incredibly all over the place with his views, but there was one long conversation under a Vatican umbrella for some reason in which he talked about, as if it were the sun coming up, that of course there is a giant war coming and we are going to be in it. He doesn't seem, from what I've read of him, to have learned any of the lessons that the rest of us have. What do you know about him? I think of him as Pat Buchanan's kid brother in the White House, but tell us more. I need to know more.
Frankly, I've never met Steve Bannon.
Interesting.
I was not familiar with Breitbart. I use Drudge to all my normal sources. I do get the impression this of Breitbart, and I agree with him. What is happening in Europe, and, you know, the liberals are doing the things that are resulting in events that are making them so unhappy in Europe. You know, when I ran in 92, you went down to the border at San Diego, and Duncan Hunter said, we got 5,000 people walking in here every weekend. Well, I said, build a security fence. And he was all for it, and they built this crude fence, triple-line fence, and stopped all the illegal immigration in that sector. By 96, they'd moved to Tucson. They moved to these other places. And what got me was not that Bush and all his friends beat me up, but that they didn't steal the issue, as Nixon would have done. And look at Europe. Bannon sees the European rising right-wing populist ethno-nationalist parties as probably the wave of the future, and it's hard for me to disagree with that, given the strength they've grown to over 15 and 20 years when they began, and the fact that the things are driving them, which is the mass migration across the Med, through Turkey, through Greece, into those two enclaves the Spanish have on their African coast, this is going to continue. The population of Africa right now, take the Maghreb, North Africa, and Sub-Saharan Africa, is 1.1 billion people. It's going to be 2 billion at mid-century and 4 billion at the end of the century. Those folks are not going to stay there with all that despotism and disease and disorder. They're going to be coming to Europe. On these great issues like that that are going to decide the fate of our civilization, I think Bannon has a better understanding than a lot of the people I know.
Coming up, belligerency, bellicosity abroad with military power was what made Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan worry about Donald Trump 18 months ago. They're still worried. This is Open Source. Trump's 100 days, 2 weeks in, with two guys from Richard Nixon's Washington 45 years ago. Pat Buchanan, then writing battle speeches for the president, and Ralph Nader, self-cast as a sort of inspector general of corporate and government folly, then and ever. And me, a rookie reporter back in the day in the New York Times Washington Bureau. In conversation this week, we're speaking of the Bannon generation and the grim determination on the faces of that Trump Corps. I was pretty sure Steve Bannon had never been a raider with Nader. Ralph Nader, what do you know about Steve Bannon? Never one of your raiders, I suspect.
He was for the Consumer Protection Agency.
I don't know that much about him, but I'm more intrigued than I can express as to his influence over Trump. I mean, he seems to have more influence over Trump than even his son-in-law or anyone else in the White House. And I don't know why. He certainly doesn't have Trump's type of personality. It's almost like a palace clique here that's beginning to form. I think we're going to see a lot of internecine fighting between the White House and the Pentagon and the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security, not only because of lack of consultation, they read about things in the press first, but because they disagree on policy.
Right, I agree with that.
You know, Trump was not careful about that. In fact, Matt Flynn disagrees with Mad Dog Mattis on a lot of things.
Yep.
As Pat knows better than anybody you've interviewed on your shows, Chris.
He knows a lot.
Once you get that kind of internecine antagonism and folly, you get more leaks, you get more intrigue, you get more paralysis, you get more scapegoating.
But you know, Ralph, I've just finished my book, Nixon's White House Wars, The Battles That Made and Broke a President and Divided America Forever. Isn't that true of almost every White House? I mean, that you get in there, you get the cliques in there, you get the, at least in Nixon's White House, where the smaller group was the conservatives. You had liberals in there and Elliot Richardson and others and Schultz and all these folks. This is true of every one of these White Houses. And I think Trump, from what I've read about him, structures conflict into his staff. Nixon did, I believe. You know, you brought in Moynihan, then you brought in Arthur Burns at the same level. You had Kissinger against Rogers. Of course, Kissinger brings in all his people, not one of whom I knew when they came into the White House. And they weren't with us in the campaign. This is the way things develop. Sessions and Bannon and Miller, from what I hear, are very much in tune with sort of the new issues that Trump brought in that helped bring me to him. And the others, I'm sure, in there are not in on that. They come out of the regular Republican, you know, the Paul Ryan types up on the Hill.
Yeah, but you know, the intensity and the grim-faced determination of each one of these beliefs seems to be much higher than prior administrations, especially at the get-go. I mean, Sessions is not going to take anything, and Bannon is not going to take anything, and Flynn is not going to take anything, and Mattis is not going to take anything, and Tillerson is not a pushover. So you're going to get very, very serious early year conflicts here that are going to be very, very destabilizing. And the Republicans, as you know, on the Hill, they don't know what the hell's coming. I mean, they're part of the old establishment.
They certainly are.
Pat, I want to throw you one thing in Steve Bannon's favor. He is right that the press should be embarrassed by its performance over the last 2 years. They missed the story entirely. They don't know the condition of the country. They backed a terribly weak horse in Hillary Clinton. Pipe down, please, and let's listen. Let's reinventory.
Bannon is right in this sense. Now, you know, I don't want to push my book too much, but I have a chapter on how the Agnew speeches and the first major attacks on the press came about. This wasn't a premeditated war. Nixon's first year, I mean, you read his inaugural, it reads like something Ramsey Clark would have delivered, you know, reaching out to everybody and everything. And you got the mass demonstrations and the people rioting, and then the media saying, get rid of him, it's Nixon's war. He just come in there. And then he gives the best speech of his life, the silent majority, and the country sort of with it. And then the media, the TV networks tear it all apart.
To extend Pat's remarks, Nixon signed into law the EPA, OSHA, Consumer Product Safety Commission. He signed the air and water pollution laws. And this is what Trump wants to roll back. Now, we haven't talked about the rollback of critical health and safety regulations, which deal with preventing indiscriminate violence. That is, conservatives and liberals die in the workplace and their children breathe toxic air. We haven't even begun, Chris, to talk about the backlash on that one.
Well, let's talk about the real opposition. Steve Bannon says the press is the opposition. I think that's crazy.
That's exactly right. Let me say why. When I was with Nixon's White House, just like today, do you think our opposition, the real threat to us, was Mike Mansfield, Senate Majority Leader, and John McCormick, Speaker of the House? The adversaries we had, at that time, the TV3 TV networks were the primary source of national and international news for two-thirds of the American people, 60-some percent, and it was controlled by a handful of people who didn't like Nixon, didn't agree with us, didn't like what we were doing, mm-hmm. and were hostile to us. And so everything we did is going through that filter before it reaches the American people. They are the main adversaries.
You were right then, Pat. They were the filter, but the filter is broken. The filter is gone. The filter was incredibly ineffective against Donald Trump.
But it's disintegrated. There's no doubt about it. It's fragmented terribly.
Okay, so it was a war with the press. The press really started it. Donald Trump won it. But I would say the opposition is something else that we barely know. Maybe you know it, Ralph. It's people in the street. And I think what I've seen, and Boston's a crazy place to look for the whole country, but people feel there's a fight here. And they feel this march was something serious. The next one, 2 days ago, was extraordinarily powerful. And I think people are just ready to go back to fundamental American values, even your values, even neighborly values. We welcome strangers. We respect people of all faiths.
Well, you know what Trump's biggest mistake is, and what will eventually bring him down, is he's offending people's sense of personal dignity. Whether they're women, whether they're Muslims, whether they're other minorities, African Americans, Hispanics, LGBT, regardless of your positions on this, you offend people's sense of personal dignity, and they get very, very motivated. I mean, 700 people today will die in hospitals due to mishaps, hospital-induced infections, malpractice, errors, etc., according to the Johns Hopkins Medical School study last March. It isn't even discussed. 700 a day, I want to emphasize that, 250,000 a year, and it's indiscriminate. It doesn't matter your race, color, creed, etc. So you see, if you offend people's personal dignity, you're in real trouble. But you can completely ignore massive casualties in the workplace, in the environment, in the hospitals, and get away with it. And Trump is not smart enough to know that what got him this far, a series of discriminant insults and support of other people, is going to get him in deep trouble in this country.
Ralph, I want to know, what's the playbook for the opposition? And how does the press cover it?
Well, I think it all comes down to Congress. I mean, Congress is viewed as ineffectual, gridlocked, sectarian, out for their own careers and re-election. But unfortunately, it's the only Congress we got. It isn't the Congress we looked for. And it's the Congress that has the most powerful authority under the Constitution. The taxing, the appropriation, the impeachment, the investigation. And I think people in this country, if they just go into demonstrations where the energy goes into the ether and next day it's old news, they've got to zero in on their 535 senators and representatives.
But, you know, Ralph, the Congress, with due respect, is an institutional coward. It's given up its power over money to the Federal Reserve and won't even ask to take a look at the books. It's given up the war power to the President of the United States. I mean, what is Barack Obama doing drawing red lines against the Syrian government? Who authorized him to take us to war? Congress does nothing about that. They got us into the wars. With regard to social policy, whether you believe in abortion or same-sex marriage, it's a matter left to democratically elected legislators. So the Supreme Court grabs it from them, and the Congress does nothing.
You're right in terms of—
The reason they don't do anything is because they want to be reelected, and they don't want to take controversial stands. And whatever you say about presidents, they will.
Well, you know, the only time they stiffen their backbone is when they get the heat from back home. And if it's the right kind of heat, maybe they'll start upholding their oath to support the Constitution and exercise their rights instead of handing them over to every president because they want to escape responsibility. And as you said, the whole war power authority has been completely given over to the president. A president can start any war, get away with any war. The Libyan attack, Hillary's war, was the most extreme. It was not authorized in funding. It was not appropriated in funding. It was not declared. It was just a black budget appropriation by Obama to overthrow the regime without considering the massive blowback and a third of Africa destabilized. That's what happens when Congress does not uphold its constitutional authority.
Well, what leads you to believe Congress is suddenly... It's suddenly good. I don't want to use the vernacular, but it's suddenly going to, you know, acquire a certain measure of courage.
But the people back home, Pat.
Look, you know, they didn't go
there's after... There's left-right support against invading Syria. You remember that, the tremendous outburst of letters and emails?
Yes, I do. We were pushing for it. The country demanded
right.
that they stand up. But even then... Obama was looking to them for counsel for that, you know.
Yeah.
And finally, I agree with you. They did get them to vote not to go to war against Syria.
Yeah, they basically said it's coming in 99-1 against it from our constituents, Mr. President. We better get out of there.
Ralph, and then Pat, I want to take it back to the Tea Party and Occupy. Occupy put on a memorable show until people told them to run along. Tea Party, meantime, took over the Republican Party. The sign I like best at the Women's March was, Democrats, you did this to yourselves. What are the Democrats got to do, and what is the opposition got to do, Ralph, to make that a real vehicle again?
They need new leadership. The best and easiest and most efficient transition in Washington in recent months was Nancy Pelosi to Nancy Pelosi. Four-time loser. They are not generating young leadership. They're not generating middle-aged leadership. They're basically tossing the card between themselves in their 70s and 80s. And that's true around the country, too. There's no young leadership, no new energy whatsoever. Anybody who tries to go after them, they know how to do them in.
You know, I tend to agree with that, but I do believe that Republicans, they're over-optimistic. When you get to the presidential level, this was as Wellington said of Waterloo, a damn near-run thing. The Republicans lost by close to 3 million votes. And I do believe the demographic changes and the existence of that blue wall, the reality of that has not gone away simply because Trump got together the, you know, enough of the blue-collar workers in states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. I don't understand how they managed to lose all those congressional seats and state legislative seats. When I came into politics at the time of the Goldwater election, Republicans had 140 seats in the House. They're outnumbered 2-1 in the House, 2-1 in the Senate, and 2-1 in governorships.
Pat, I'm just thinking you've got enough, you know, bones to pick with Wall Street and the War Party. I mean, how would you think of organizing an effective opposition, not to Trump, but to the deeper trends in this society?
I mean, I've never sort of put myself in the position of the National Democrats in a long-term strategy, but I do think they ought to be populist, working class, but their trouble is that, you know, they're becoming a party, basically, of interest groups. You know, someone used that phrase a long time ago, the Democratic Party is a gathering of warring tribes that have come together in anticipation of common plunder. And I think, I mean, that gets pretty close to it. You got the African-American group, you got the, and Ralph has mentioned them, the gay groups, they're interested in their concerns, and the feminists and the women, they want theirs, and the Hispanics want theirs. In my view, I mean, look, I've always looked at it as a Republican strategist, would be to get these, use the old wedge driving in these various constituencies. But I don't know how. Look, the French spend something like 58% of GDP on government, and the Americans are about at 38%. But the control of it, the regulation of it, is much larger than that. I think you reach sort of an end of the road to what government can do successfully without, you know, creating more adversaries on the other side. I mean, this process begun with the New Deal, we take a little from the rich and we spread it all out among this huge group. And the game is almost over, I think.
Well, the Democrats began their decline when they abandoned the economic interests of the working class. I mean, you remember it used to be said about Roosevelt and the Democrats, they're the party of the working class. And when they started abandoning it in favor often, and they shouldn't have been zero sum, of the civil liberties or other interests, it allowed them to raise more money from corporations, starting about 1979 when Tony Coelho, the Democrat who's in charge of fundraising in the House of Representatives, said, hey, Democrats, you can raise a lot of money from corporate PACs. Don't leave it to the Republicans. That's when they began losing those blue-collar workers in the Midwest, for example. And in the last 16 years, the Republicans have been saved by the Electoral College twice. So they basically won two presidential elections, having lost the popular vote. Al Gore won the popular vote. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote.
Before that, Ralph, I mean, let's take Richard Nixon, non-charismatic figure, two-time loser in 1964-65. He leads the Republicans in a comeback in 66. And then we won the White House in 68 with 43%, but Wallace got 13%. And what we did in those years is basically you got the went for the what we called then the Northern Catholics and Southern Protestants. Southern Protestants, we said, look, Wallace is for segregation and we're not, but we agree with you on Harvard. We agree with you about liberals. We agree with you about the radicals on campus. We agree with all these other things. And also the Northern Catholics. Nixon got 22% of the Catholic vote, which is huge, in 1960. 68, 33%. By 72, we got 54% of the Catholic vote. These are working class Frank Rizzo, Dick Daley Catholics, those guys, and the Wallace vote in the South because he was out of the race after he'd been shot. And you put together a 49-state landslide, and Reagan did it again, 44 states and then 49 states in 84. And what you did is you put together the socially conservative, basically progressive New Deal Democrats, but very socially conservative church-going folks, you know, who do their duty, and the same ones that Trump got now. But you notice now you can barely win Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and places like California are gone for good now. It's a changed situation.
Ralph Nader, Pat Buchanan, what I'm hearing is that we've got to do this again. This smacked of the real thing. Ralph, Pat, thank you.
Well, thank you. And Ralph, good talking to you again, my friend.
You're welcome. Onward.
Onward, Emerson said. Ever onward. Pat Buchanan's new memoir, forthcoming, is Nixon's White House Wars, The Battles That Made and Broke a President and Divided America Forever. Ralph Nader's political manual, out in paperback, is Breaking Through Power. It's easier than we think. Just ask Donald Trump. And not-so-solemn Ralph has just published his first fable fantasy titled Animal Envy, in the manner of Charlotte's Web or Dr. Doolittle, talking to the animals in the digital age. There's more on our website, radioopensource.org. Sign up for our newsletter, subscribe to the podcast, and while you're there, think of making a donation to the hardest working team in radio. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.